Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. Sure. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling. And to my immediate right is
Jen Gluckow, founder of Sales in a New York Minute.
And together we are doing this Sell or Die podcast, and it's killer. It's the best podcast on the planet.
People have been asking me when new episodes are coming out. And we have really let you guys down.
And we have
back now.
We have episodes in the can.
Oh, yeah.
Because we've been traveling a lot this summer. But the point is, you're about to get information that will change the way you think about sales and change your success ratio.
So coming up, we have an amazing guest on our show.
Yeah. Who is it, Jen? Let me tell you.
Okay, tell me.
It's Peter James. Peter James was a Navy SEAL. Now, if you don't know anything about Navy SEALs, let me tell you that they're the epitome of a soldier. They have gone through literally hell and come back to tell about it. And Peter has taken his amazing, incredible capability, his assets, his dedication, and his skills, and converted them into sales. He's now a sales leader. And he's going to talk to us this morning about how he recruits, how he trains, how he encourages, and how he has a team of amazingly successful salespeople.
Plus, he likes to talk through telling stories, and so you're going to hear a lot of amazing stories that I think you'll be able to relate to and have lessons that you can take away and use to improve yourself.
So without further ado...
No, well, before we get to Peter, Jeffrey, what's going on in your sales world?
Well, as you know, Jen, we've been flying.
I know. And driving, because I was the driver.
Here's the deal. You have to... Our plane was delayed last night for a couple of hours. You would have thought that the world was coming to an end.
Oh, man,
it
was crazy.
People were so pissed off, and they're yelling and stomping, I'm going to change my job.
I should give up my career. I hate flying.
Right. The point is, are people that turn on their phones during the flight and play solitaire. These are people that have no life whatsoever. And they're complaining about something that they have no right to complain about because they have to go back to nothingness. And so your job, if you're thinking about it, is to have something to do that benefits you, that challenges your thought process, that makes you a better person, so that even if there is a delay, so what?
I had fun with it.
So did I.
We were the only happy people in the, like a 4-hour time span?
And we don't play solitaire, we play word cookies, which is a bigger game. But I was writing, Jen was writing, we were doing research.
We have
a couple of things coming
chatting.
Up this week.
Yeah, we're having fun.
We're preparing for our week back in Charlotte, and everybody else was...
Guy behind us left his iPad on the first plane we were on.
Yeah,
forgot it on the second.
It was one of those nightmarish nights that you could have either been pissed off about or not cared about. We chose not to care about it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best thing. So
if you're a traveler and you care about planes being delayed, then you should not be traveling.
Exactly.
Because almost every plane sometimes is going to get delayed. And when I changed my mindset around this, it changed everything for me.
Exactly. So we were in Fargo, North Dakota, a place that,
it's a really nice place. It's just hard to get to.
And they had,
it was really hot, by the way.
But it was
like
really nice.
100 degrees today, yesterday. It may be snowing there today. I don't know.
The people were very nice. And recommended a restaurant outside of the Doubletree, and there's only one Doubletree in Fargo. It's like an Irish pub.
We had a Doubletree?
Yeah. Oh. It's an Irish pub. And they had the best shepherd's pie I've ever had. I mean, it was like a miracle. Like, where did this food come from?
It was so good that you got one to go and ate it in the car and then went to the airport.
I did.
It was a lovely smell.
Well, anyway. But if you're into shepherd's pie, hit Fargo. It's worth
it. It may take you a couple hours to get there, but best shepherd's pie.
It's worth the trip. And when you wake up, you're in Fargo. It was just a nice place. It's middle America. It's a place where honest people live and talk. And in spite of the show and in spite of the movie.
I've never seen the show or the movie. But
it's a pretty cool place. So that's my week. Yes,
well,
we've been to New York.
I had that same week.
Yes, we've been to New York. Yes, we've been to, I've been to Mexico. There's been a lot of things happening over the course of the last couple of weeks. But the bottom line is I'm writing new stuff. I'm writing new things. I'm doing a project with Napoleon Hill. We're going to relaunch a couple of our books.
Those are two separate projects.
Exactly. And you'll see as it kind of goes along, we're on fire at the moment.
Oh, yeah. We're having a blast.
So let's talk about our guest.
All right.
I'm going to introduce Peter James because he's my friend, but he's an amazing character. And the minute you talk to somebody who's been in that kind of a role, the minute you talk to them, you know they're a special person. Mm-hmm. Because they have been through literally living hell. And rather than me tell you about it, I'm going to let him talk about it. Please help me welcome the great Peter James. We are joined today by the great Peter James. What's his last name? No, he has actually has two first names, and they're two either middle names or how'd you get along your whole life?
Biblical names, whatever, you know, as people, I answer to either one. So,
got it.
You know, if you call me James or Peter, it doesn't matter.
Do people call you by your last name a lot?
In the military, everybody calls you by your last name. So I was used to being calling James, right? You know, in my adult life, everybody asks me Pete or Peter, and I go, I don't really care.
Right.
Call me Hey You, it's fine.
Yeah. So he's two of the 12 apostles. Let's look at it that way. But he is a Navy SEAL, was a practicing Navy SEAL. Now he's just out of the water, practicing the same tactics in front of a sales force. And I want to begin not just to introduce him, but let's find out what it was like to be a SEAL. Because most people don't know. They see the thing, Navy SEALs did this, they killed this guy, or they went on this mission, or something happened. But what did you do like during the day? What was the stuff?
You know, I always talk about, you know, it's funny because people, especially when I was in, it was kind of a mystery that you were in the teams is what it was. And I always look at it as a bunch of ordinary guys that are asked to do inordinary or extraordinary things. Mm-hmm. But everybody that I was with are just normal people, you know, that just have a mindset of, that they want to do something and do it very well. And they won't quit, you know.
No big deal.
It doesn't seem to be a big deal. You know, one of the stories that comes to mind is that, you know, we're talking about being prepared, and I think part of being on the teams is being prepared. You always want to make sure you're prepared for anything that might happen to you. And, you know, one of the things that taught me about that was we were doing submarine lock-in, lock-out training in Kings Bay, Georgia. I think I was 18.
Lock-in, lock-out means keep the water out?
Yeah, only we're putting the water in, which means that we're going to lock in. So when we're locking out is that you flood water onto the submarine, you open the chamber, and you come out, and you swim in the water, do whatever you need to do, come back, and then you lock back in and flood the water back out of the chamber. And probably I think everybody would understand that submariners don't really want water on their submarine.
Bingo.
Right.
Yeah. Harder to breathe.
Yeah, it is a little bit harder to breathe, especially pressurized, probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, so we're doing some training at the docks in Kings Bay, Georgia, and, you know, I'm running through it, and I'm in water up to my chest, and I'm sweating. And again, I don't know how you sweat in water, but my hands were all, you know, sweaty, clammy. My face was sweating. I'm drenched with sweat because I just really wasn't as prepared as I should have been to perform the exercise. I got the Admiral of the Sixth Fleet, the captain of the ship, all these high ranking officers. I'm a little E4, you know, and not doing a very good job. When I was done with that, I said, this is never going to happen to me again. It can't happen to me again because this is just a lack of preparedness on my part, which is embarrassing being somebody who just came out of BUDS and knows the importance of being prepared. So the next time I got to do this, we were actually underway in the Gulf Stream of off of Florida between there and the Bahamas. And you know, and as we're going through this process, you know, I'm much better prepared, so now I can enjoy it. So as we're enjoying this thing, we're locking out, flooding water on the submarine, things seem to be going well. Get out, one of the best experiences, of most memorable experiences of my life is that, you know, you lock out and I can see the submarine is 600 feet long from bow to stern. You can see the sail of the submarine, you can look up above us and you see this sub-tender that's 300 feet long from bow to stern. And we're at 80 feet, water's 84 degrees. I'm used to diving in Virginia Beach, the clarity's not like that, it's not that warm. school of hammerhead sharks are swimming by the sail of the submarine.
Cool, just to say hey.
Just to say hey, and you're kind of like, it's taking your breath away, and you're seeing this, and you feel like you're in a movie, and James Bond, and you're looking at it, and you're like, no, but this is actually me doing it. So we finish up, we were doing these operations for about 2 weeks, and going from where I really thought that I did such a very poor job of doing something, mm-hmm. I ended up getting a letter of commendation from that same admiral that I crashed and burned from.
Cool.
And he's just saying, like, when we do these in the future, you know, not that I would be the only guy, because there's many people, but he just, it was nice of him to say that I want him doing this. So it's just the result of being prepared.
Also, you took responsibility. You didn't blame someone and say it was their fault.
It was a crappy
day.
Yeah,
it was bad, whatever.
The water was cold.
Well, I think personal accountability is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, if you do something wrong, or if you could do something better, it's never anyone else's fault.
Right.
It's always yours.
Yeah.
If you have a bad experience with a sales call, guess what? It's so, not the customer, it's you.
Let me bring it back to reality, because most of you can't really relate to your time when you were flooding a submarine or letting the water out of the submarine. But you do, from time to time, give a presentation. And oftentimes, salespeople will tell me that they were nervous. And I tell people, no, you're unprepared. That the more prepared you are, the less nervous you are. I mean, I've had the blessing of giving 2,500 customized talks to corporations over my career. I've never been nervous for one of them.
And even the first one?
No. My prime two reasons are I love what I do and I'm prepared. And if you're prepared, you don't have to worry about a script or a thing, or you're just ready. I use slides. I didn't use slides for the first 7 or 8 years, but I use slides to keep me on track. So I can, if I lose where I am, I just go click.
That's the funny thing. That's the only thing I use slides for too. A lot of people want to pull this narrative up on a slide. Oh. No, all I want is a word up there.
Exactly.
It's just in case. You know,
I'm a two-word guy. Yeah.
Me too. I can tend to get off on a tangent sometimes. At least that's what my staff tells me, right? And so I just put things up there just to keep me on track.
I will tell you, though, that the stories are the glue to whatever you're presenting.
Yeah.
The expression is facts and figures are forgotten, but stories are retold. Mm-hmm. So you'll talk about your preparation time or how you won this thing, other than you could also say, well, I prepare very well. Like, really, who cares?
And who wants to hear somebody read if you have a presentation up there? Yeah. Does anybody want to sit anybody look
it.
At it?
They can
right,
read it, they can if it's
read
on the screen.
It. Why do you need me if I'm going to read? If I'm not going to tell a story
there
to
has
articulate
to be some,
it.
Yeah, there has to be back talk. Talk about it rather than it. But you have a sales team. You've got 5,800 guys on your sales team. And you report to corporate people. You have upper pressure and lower pressure. Mm-hmm. Pete, how do I make the sale? Or Pete, why didn't you make enough sales? Those are your two. And you're like in the middle going,
It's a pressure that I embrace. Perfectly fine.
I understand that. No, I understand that. But the bottom line is the sales leader is the person who is most accountable or responsible for the money that comes into the company, period. You're responsible for the money. The software guys are responsible for the software, but it's not as measurable. You know, like, when will you be done? Well, we'll be done by October 15th. Oh, wait, we made a mistake. It's going to be October 32nd. Oh, wait a minute. No, we made another mistake. It's going to be the week after November the 5th.
But no matter when it's done, you still have to sell it.
Yeah, well, no. But here's the deal. They don't have the same kind. If Pete can't miss a number at the end of the month and say, "Ah, we'll do it
right,
by November."
The product wasn't ready.
Do you listen to me when I talk at our office? Because that's what I say.
No.
I go, guys, you know what? If you don't meet a production deadline, doesn't mean I get to not produce.
Right.
Hey, look, you know what? One of the things I think that drives, because accountability is big, I think, on the sales team, because everybody always says that I want to make things fun at work, enjoyable. You know, I personally think the way you make it fun and enjoyable is by putting standards out there and making something that's a little bit difficult to reach. If it was easy, I use this analogy. If I told you to walk around the building and come back to me, you're going to be really proud of that accomplishment? I think not.
Right.
At least if you're a healthy individual.
I did it.
Yeah. But now if I have you go out and run a marathon that you've never done before at the end of the day, and you run this marathon, you go like, now I have something proud to be, that I've accomplished. Same thing in sales. If everybody can hit the number, it's probably not that impressive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So hold some accountability, put some goals out in place, and then hold people accountable to the goals that they've established.
So what do you look for when you're hiring? people?
So my team last year, they hear me say this all the time. Whenever I interview, I go through the same spiel. And, you know, when I talk about people, they start talking about experience, start talking about stuff. And they look at me a little funny. I said, I don't really care about experience. And I said, what I care about is attitude, character, and effort. That's what I care about.
Attitude, character, effort.
You got it. Attitude, because I believe that anybody that comes in with a positive attitude every day has good character when they do the right thing when no one's looking and brings monumental effort to me, I can help be successful. By the way, one of my guys came up with that. He calls it the ACE acronym.
I like that.
You're the ACE of sales.
And they built a sign for me and put it up there. And at the last meeting, they said, hey, this is what Pete preaches. And not only does he preach it, he believes it. And I said, because I do believe that it has to be genuine as well. Mm-hmm. I can't BS people left and right and expect them to trust me. Because the first part of that is attitude, character, and effort. So I can trust, empower, and support
you. In the short time that I've known you, I don't detect a lot of BS in there.
No, none.
What you get in an interview is what you get in the sales meeting.
Exactly.
Is what you get in my personal life.
Exactly.
Is what you get on the sales floor.
Exactly.
If you don't like me, I am what I am.
This
you know?
Is not going to be
tough
well
shit. If you don't like me, get out.
Exactly.
Again, do you have a microphone in my office? Because I've told people that too. If you don't like what you get now, it's probably not a good place for you to work.
Exactly. We do the same thing, but we insert a couple of words in there.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to be nice now.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're rated E, it's okay.
Yeah, okay.
But I wanted to throw one thing at you. When you set a goal for a salesperson, when you set a goal for the team, typically there's going to be one or two or three people that are always going to win because they're the ones that people hate, and it's the girl in high school that was always raising her hand. I want to punch her so bad.
So here's an interesting thing. So I got this girl, Allie. She's brand new, and she probably has not a prototypical background for being in sales. But when she came in, I loved her. Right? She was great. And sometimes I tell my interviewees that I love them in an interview, which I think is a little bit, you know, again, you get what you get with me.
It's a '60s thing, but it's not a 2017 thing.
So she comes to my office the other day and she's talking about some of the challenges she has on the sales floor. I said, let me explain to you what's going to happen here. I said, because you engage with leadership, they're going to think you're given preferential treatment. And I said, then they're going to start to try to knock you off your pedestal because here you are, this new young sales rep who's having success. Mm-hmm. It must be because Pete's doing it for you. And she starts to giggle and she goes, you know what they call me already? Pete's pet.
Oh!
And I go, you're going to have to live with that burden because you're taking responsibility and coming to me and asking for help. I don't have to go to you. I look for that characteristic in a sales rep. If I have to drag you in my office, that's the first person I know that is probably not going to be successful. The person that seeks me out and seeks out my other leaders of the team and seeks out help typically are solution finders. They find a way to get it done. Mm-hmm. And that's what you look for. Hard to find that in an interview, but that's what you try to identify. At least I try to anyway.
What are some of the ways you identify that?
You know, I do hire good people, I think. You know, that's me blowing my own horn. Is that I think I hire good people because other people want them on their team. So they raid my team all the time. And I actually take that as that's one of my goals. Is that I want to hire good people because I'm hiring entry-level people. I want other people to say, I want these people that work for you mm-hmm. or work with you. Again, I keep making that mistake because people work together they don't work for. It's a conversation. So when I come in there, my office is open. I don't have it sit behind a desk. I have it open so people have to be open and talk to me. Mm-hmm. They have to be engaged. I look for people that are conscientious. Conscientious means, did you come in dressed appropriately? Do you bring tools? Did you bring the tools of a job for an interview?
Mm-hmm.
By the way, one of the guys that I hired, he's one of my solutions engineers. I asked him for his resume and he handed it to me. I never looked at it. He goes, it was amazing to me. We went through this interview and he goes, I love the interview process with you. And you asked for my resume, but you never looked at it. I said, because I could tell from the conversation that you were bright enough to put a good resume together.
Hmm.
And if you weren't, and it looked bad visually, I probably would have looked at it. But I didn't, because as soon as I saw it, I could tell that you weren't a job hopper, because there weren't 14 million different jobs, mm-hmm. and it was well put together. So why do I need to look at it? Because you might have paid someone to put that together.
Mm.
So what do I care? At least you're bright enough to pay someone to put your resume together.
Exactly.
At least you understand
that.
To
make it look good for
Map
Anything.
And you need to come prepared.
You made it look good for me. Right. So that's the first step.
By the way, I like maps.
yeah, that's it. You know, and maybe your resume is a map of your career.
I was in the map club when I was in high school.
I was not, by the way. So those are the things. And so I'm talking to him, and I'm trying to get his impressions of where he wants to go. I'm looking for people that want to go someplace. Mm-hmm. You know, tell me where you want to be. Tell me what it looks like for you, because you're not going to be working with me in 3 to 5 years. So where do you want to go? And so someone who comes in and works 9 to 5 has a job. The person who has goals has a career. Mm-hmm. I want those people. Those are the guys that I want.
Yeah. If you want a job, there's not a good place for you.
Because I live and breathe what I do.
I look at it from a standpoint, I'll tell people this is not a job, it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. You decide how you want to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But let me, I'm going to go back, because this mirrors something that's quite extraordinary. One of my really good friends is a guy named Richard Brody, who you don't know, but he wrote Microsoft Word 1.0.
Okay.
He was in charge of HR for 1 year at Microsoft as employee number 77, and they have 3 criteria that they use to hire people at Microsoft. Smart, self-starting, past history of success. He said, Jeffrey, if you go around the Microsoft campus in Redmond, you're going to find 10,000 people that are smart, self-starting, and have a past history of success. It did okay for them. I would have added happy, but that's just me, because if you're going to be in sales and you ain't happy, it's not going to be.
It's attitude, right?
Right, exactly.
Huh? Attitude.
Attitude.
Totally.
Yeah.
Smart, happy, past history of success, and self-starting. You have to be self-starting in sales. So that's the challenge that you face when you look at somebody. I can pretty much tell if they're smart. I can pretty much tell if they're happy. I don't know about their ability to self-start.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the real fulcrum point there. But I can look at their resume or talk to them for a little bit and find out about their past history. Some questions you're not allowed to ask anymore, but the bottom line is you can certainly ask them a couple of why questions to find out, you know, what are you doing here?
I drive HR crazy because I ask all the questions you're not supposed to.
Yeah, I know.
I break all the rules.
And by the way, how old are you?
Yeah, it always seems to come out, you have kids, how old are you? But I didn't bring it up. That was them that did it, you know, so.
But it's really sad that you can't do that anymore. But, and actually, in my opinion, it's stupid.
Yeah.
But there's nothing, you know, I mean, to a personal question. If someone says that's a personal question, I want to throw them out anyway. I don't want to hire that person because they got a pipe up their ass.
Because, look, I got to get to know somebody, because it's not just that, you know, this is why, because I hire younger people, so that past history of success,
I have to
throw out the window.
Hold on. Mm-hmm. No. If they have a college degree, they have a past history of success.
Or if they ran a club in
well, so
high
those are the those
or,
are the things I look at. Right. I say, you know, so tell me something that was challenging for you and you overcome it, and what are you most proud of?
Right.
You know, so you start to tell me those things. And, you know, I hate to say this, but college is not really that important to me. I'm a college dropout. So here I am, I look
I
at
am
it.
I do too, but it's a discipline.
It is.
That if you finish, I admire people that finished, even though it doesn't do much for you.
I have an interesting perspective on it. Some of the people that, you know, that I've hired that have master's degrees are some of my worst hires. I look for a guy who has, he struggled.
Right.
If A's came too easy for you, you probably shouldn't be in sales. Mm-hmm. I want the guy who worked his ass off to get a C.
Mm-hmm.
He worked his ass off to get a C because he knew what work is like. So some of the other things, there's this other company I used to do business with, and they go, the best salespeople come from these backgrounds. How young were you when you got a job? Did you work your way through college?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you on a sports team? Do you like being part of a team?
Yeah. Are you coachable? Do you want to win?
Yeah.
Are you coachable? Do you want to win?
No, I ask this question, though, so because I don't care about winning. I look at that. I am driven to win. But I hate to lose.
Yeah.
I hate to lose. I have to win. And I want people, I saw this interview about Michael Jordan, LeBron James, and Kobe Bryant. And their premise was that Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan hated to lose more than they loved to win. And that LeBron James loved to win more than he hated to lose. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but when you see that burning desire in their eyes, I'm going like, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I want someone that hell or high water is going to come through here, and I'm going to find a way to succeed.
Yes.
No matter how long it takes.
Yes.
I won't give up.
That's a quality that cannot be denied.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone sees that in another person, or it's by example, you know, that someone watches you not quit, that's envious.
Well, I ask my team, I go, like, you know, the first one in there in the morning, even though I got a couple guys getting there real early now, it's getting tough on me as I get older. But I try to be the first one and the last one to leave. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that I'm not too good to do
that's
anything.
That's the example.
Right? Yeah, of course.
If we got, we've had things that come in, we need our chairs built together. You know, we just have these chair office chairs, right? It's a simple thing. But I'm there building the chairs with them.
Of course.
Right? Because I'm not too good
to build a chair.
As an they respect that. Yeah, they see that and you're there with them.
As an entrepreneur, when I'm really a business person, but as an entrepreneur, I'll clean the toilets when the employees...
The one over there is a little dirty, Jeffrey.
I know, but I only have to do it once. Once they know you'll do it, they'll do it.
Right, you're not too good to do anything, and I'm not. So we did this thing at Dreamforce for Salesforce, and we go out there, and you know, and we're trying to get as many scans as possible because again, the owner of our company is very competitive as well. And so we had like six guys scanning out there at Dreamforce trade show, and the only company that beat us is somebody that had 56 people scanning. We had six.
Whoa.
And the reason was is because I had myself and my leadership team out there. We were scanning, driving it, and getting it done. I'm out there all day long with them every day just like they are. And I love that, and it's the attitude of our company, our CFO, Chris Rosbrook. And he's brand new to the company. You know what he's doing? He's scanning with
us. Yeah.
And then, you know, the owner's wife, Liz, comes out.
Yep. Cool.
She's horrified, right? She is not this people person. And she goes, okay, I want to, and she's getting out of her comfort zone. Put a scanner in her hand and she's scanning and she comes to me, she goes, Pete, you know, I'm very uncomfortable. I go, Liz, we're all uncomfortable. You're walking with people you don't know and asking to grab something on them and scan them. That's what we're doing. I said, but part of this growing is getting out of your side of your comfort zone a little bit and pushing a little bit. And, you know, I don't know if that was the most, you know, most pleasurable experience in her life, but the fact is that she's willing to do it. The CFO is willing to do it. Everybody is willing to do it. And I think that's what helps make a successful organization.
Exactly. I want to back up to when you entered the SEALs. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a time you felt like quitting?
You know, so 25 years later, I went to my 25-year reunion, and a couple things happened. So
you have to go to that, by the way, don't you?
You don't have to, but it's been 25 years since I talked to any of these guys because I was in the teams a very short period of time, and you know, I was young, dumb, and full of you know what, and so I went through Buzz. I go through it, and at the end of the day, I just decided to get out. If I don't regret anything in life, but I wish I had stayed in 20 or 30 years. So a lot of these guys retired from it. And so I have the opportunity to bring my son to my 30 years reunion. It'd been 30 years. And so there's a group of guys there, and time just melts away. Mm-hmm. It melts away because you haven't seen these guys, but you experience some intense emotions with them. And I just remember this individual's name was Mike Williams. He comes up to me and he grabs and gives me a hug and he goes, man, I've been waiting to see you for like 25 years. And I'm not an emotional guy, but it tends to make you a little bit emotional. Mm-hmm. And he looks to my son and says, he goes, I'm going to bet you didn't know that your dad had so many brothers, even though you have never met him before. And so it was a special moment. The reason why I bring that up is because there was one time where I really thought about quitting. And it was during Hell Week. And Hell Week is this time you stay up for five and a half days, minimal sleep, almost none. And we're about day three, and it's called the Tijuana Mud Flats. And you're sitting there in this river that's full of the sewage that comes from Tijuana, and it's cold, and you've been up for 3 days, you're tired, you're bloody, you're dirty, you've been working, and you're on the edge of where you think
you're
you can
on the
go.
Brink. Right.
And, you know, and one of the instructors who happened to be a little bit more sadistic comes up and says, hey, man, you guys look too warm. I think you need to go get out in the water. And what happened before is they brought us up by the fire for like a minute and a half, timing, you know, because they know what's going on. As soon as they get there, and they're like, you know, he's yelling, goes, what are you guys doing by the fire? You're worthless. You're weak. You're lazy. Go out there and cool off in the ocean. I'm standing by the ocean and I'm going like, I think I'm done. And I just heard one guy's voice come on. He goes, come on, Pete, we're waiting for you. And it was that guy, Mike. If he didn't say that to me at that time, the probability of me quitting was extremely high.
Wow.
And so now I go forward a little bit, and I'm sitting around at this 30-year reunion, and I go, I'd always been embarrassed the fact that I wanted to quit that one time. It's been a sticking point for me for 30 years. I thought it was a colossal failure because I wanted to quit. So I'm sitting there talking to a couple guys that I graduated with. They're both my OICs, officers in charge of my boat crew. And both of them happen to be Olympic athletes. And I look at them, and I'm not an athlete, by the way. I'm not that great an athlete. I have to work hard at everything I do because I'm not a great athlete. I'm slow, uncoordinated. I do it by sheer will of effort. And I looked over to them, and I go, you guys ever think about quitting? And they go, every effing day. And I went, seriously? It got like it lifted this load off my shoulders that I'd had for 30
right,
years.
Right.
And they go, what about you? And I go, I thought about quitting once, and I've been beating myself up for it forever. And they just start laughing at me. And I'm like, okay. So sometimes it's good to share and know where you're
exactly.
at and challenge
yourself.
Yeah. You know, so.
Especially with the guys that are in the same boat.
Oh, yeah.
No yeah.
Literally
yeah.
the
yeah.
same
yeah.
boat.
Well, and we actually were, yeah, in the same boat, literally. So it was good.
So now you have a bunch of people, and some of them are a little wishy-washy, and some of them are weak, and some of them need a smack in the back of the head. But you can't do that anymore because it's not... Soldier, you know, you can't be doing that.
I thought
that.
Waterboarding would be a good idea, but my HR department said no.
Exactly. So there's a discipline that they have to have. How do you convey that discipline to them so that they succeed?
You know, I think it's through stories, too. You know, I tell stories to guys on, you know, different things I've experienced through my career and, mm-hmm. and how people were successful. And that I think that there's a part of where there's empathy, too. So if you understand the challenges they have to go through and if they can understand that there's fear in everybody, it's not just you. You're afraid to do this. And you're sometimes there's this fear of success and, you know, you're almost there. And how do I keep persevering through it? And that's the difference between winning and losing. Motivational stuff is, I think, is important, keeps me going, right? You know, at the end of the day, how do you stay motivated every day? How do you facilitate people's success? And I think that's from having empathy with them, understanding what it takes and being able to articulate it. And don't say, you know, when I did it, it was here, even though some of that comes out, is that here's what you have to go through. Setting realistic expectations, making them understand that this is what it takes to be successful, and letting them know that all those challenges they have are real, but it's not an excuse to not get it done. Mm-hmm.
I think that there isn't one person out there who's trying to make a sale that you couldn't step in and either help them make the sale or make the sale for them.
Ooh,
and they
colossal
know that.
Colossal mistake, though. Yeah. I don't ever do that.
But I'm just telling you.
I mean, I wouldn't say I'd never do it, but sometimes you have to let people fail.
Yeah.
And again, I don't say fail because I think I told you guys earlier, I don't believe in failure. Failure means you quit. I think that the only way to fail is to quit. So by definition, if you don't quit, it may take me longer to get there than I thought,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not going to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when guys do things and they experience it and then you coach them afterwards and say, hey, here's what I could do. And occasionally, there's this fear I have with people. If I come in, and this is my, I have two young leaders, I go, guys, stop doing for them all the time. They become dependent on you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whenever they get into a tight situation, it becomes dependent. So one of my guys the other day comes up to me and he goes, hey, I need you to finish closing this deal for me. He wants to talk to the VP. And I said, no. I said, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go back and tell him this. And I could see he was tensed up a little bit. And so he goes, okay. So he runs in and he comes back. I've never seen a guy more excited. He comes out, he goes, he bought. And I said, see, you don't need me.
But he got that feeling that he never would have had if you did it for him.
That's what I try. And sometimes it's lost on the guys, you know.
There's two schools for that. Every once in a while, it's not making it for somebody, it's teaching them a lesson.
How to make
no
it.
Doubt, I agree. Yeah. Okay. I don't say I never do that. I try to fight from it. There was a girl that I'm sitting there and I'm out and doing a field sale and this guy literally picks up the pen. And he goes, I used to sell security for a living. He goes, well, how do I get this installed? And I'm waiting for her to put the contract in front of him to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, well, I'm gonna go back to the office and get a proposal.
Oh, no.
And I'm sitting there, he has the pen in his hand. And I'm sitting there, and this is one of the most difficult things I had. I'm sitting there, I literally am biting my tongue and biting my lip. I go like, I am not going to rescue her. I'm not going to do it. So it gets all done, and you can see the look of bewilderment in the customer's eyes. He goes, I think this is simple. He goes, he actually said this. He goes, I think this is a pretty simple solution, but if you have to send it back to me, fine. We walk outside, and I go, D, I said, you had a contract in your hand. An agreement, and he had a pen. Why didn't you just have him sign it? And she goes, oh, she goes, well, I would have thought you wanted me to propose. I go, no, he would have signed a blank contract. I said, so what you're going to do, you're going to turn around and walk back inside. Yeah. And you're going to go like, hey, this just dawned on me. You really want to get this done quickly, right? Why don't we just go ahead and sign the paperwork now?
Hello.
And he goes, she actually, I said, so how did it go when you went inside? Because I did not go back in with her. He asked me literally why I didn't do that the first time. So, you know, those
that's
are things.
Classic.
And don't get me wrong. You know, there are times when you do bail people out. I just try to balance those things out to say you learn more from experiencing yourself than you do from when other people are doing it.
Well, early on in my consulting career, and I can't remember, let's say it's 1976-ish, I'm with a sales team in a screen printing company, and they had seven or eight sales guys. And I said, tell me about a sales situation that you have. And one really cocky bastard says, I'm really having trouble getting people on the phone. I said, well, who's like a big deal for you? And he goes, no. I said, do you have their number? And he goes, yeah, I do. I said, give me the number. So I pick the phone up and I dial the number and I go, I'd like to speak to Mr. McGillicuddy. Yeah. Yeah, it's a business matter of a personal nature. Yeah, Bob? Yeah, hang on. And I hand the phone to the sales guy. And everybody just shit. Because it was a moment where it was a teaching moment, but it was a don't give me a crappy excuse.
Well, you know, that all the time, the guys will come into me because we've got this email age now, and I go like, please don't send emails. Pick up the phone, call somebody. And you know, because I have this inside team. I'm like, no, an email is a follow-up. And so the other day, one of the guys came in and goes, I'm trying to get a hold of this, guy. And I always say, all right, so we'll call him right now. And you know, and sometimes you can see the tenseness of people going like, you're gonna get the phone call.
No,
I'm gonna call him right now. So I pick up the phone, and this was the poor guy. I pick up the phone and call, and the guy picks up on the second answer. And I talk to him, I go, hey Steve, how's it going? This is Pete with Map Anything, you know, I run the sales team, I just wanna reach out to you, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, yeah, I've been trying to get a hold of so-and-so. And the guy's on the line, like,
I said, so.
I love that.
Because this was really difficult for me. It took me one call to get a hold of him, you know.
Two rings.
Yeah, two rings, and it was good to go. But he must have known it was me, the boss, that was calling, so that's why he answered.
Right.
He must have known that.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
Magic caller ID.
Yeah.
But I think that there is there are reasons and there's excuses.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there is a genuine reason. The guy's out of town for a couple of weeks or something like that. But the rest of it is the guy wouldn't return my call. That's an excuse.
Out of town? He doesn't have a cell phone?
Well, Seriously? Listen, I know, but sometimes it's vacation. Sometimes you just don't want to push that lever.
Well, you know, isn't it the balance? You know, we call it polite persistence, you know, and of course, I steal that from one of my guys. He came up with that, and you know, and we use another one, too. I'll give him credit for it. It's Doug, one of the guys who works on my team. It's like, when it's too tough for everybody else, it's just right for us.
Yeah, cool.
Right?
Exactly.
So when it's too tough for everybody else, it's just right for us. And so I take that mantra because of my background, because I think everybody can relate to it, and I say, you know what? I'm looking for people that want to be on the best team, not just be on the team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so those things, I think they all tie together.
I had an audience yesterday in North Dakota,
Fargo.
My second time in Fargo, North Dakota. And I said to a room of, I don't know, 100 and some people, how many of you have never been to New York City?
This was astonishing. Yeah.
3/4 of the room raised their hand.
Well, I told you, I'd never been to New York till last year.
I'm just telling you, yeah, but you're a SEAL. So you've been 100 feet underwater.
You've been all over.
You can shoot a gun. You know what to do. Mm. These people are, it's cold out. I'm going to go ice fishing. And they're really lovely people. They're wonderful, family-oriented, honest people. But I don't think that their drive is as intense as if you're trying to catch a subway and it's 8:00 in the morning and you're 5 people deep and you need to be on the train and you shove your way in.
And there's 30 people in front of you and you have to squeeze in.
Well, here's a joke they used to tell. I was born and raised in Florida. And so this was a kid. There's this kid from New York comes down and he's talking to his teacher the teacher is from New York, and comes back to him and asks this Southern kid to say, hey, could you go run to the office and get this for me? And he goes, run? What do you mean run? Down here in the South, we walk.
Yeah, you know, so. Exactly. Yeah.
So that's why I don't think I really fit in the South, because I'm like, I run everywhere I go, you know?
So this is the challenge for you listening or watching. Everything has a purpose. And the purpose of being in sales is to not just make the sale, it's to think, to build a relationship, and be able to create it so strong that the person refers to you literally in an unsolicited manner. You can do that, you're gonna win. But the sales leader is the person that has to inspire that, not just motivate it, they have to inspire that. And if you can catch that inspiration, you're gonna make more sales.
Wow. Yeah. That was amazing.
That was a great attitude, character, effort.
Ace.
And I think that we should get Peter back and talk to him about what the net of that is. Mm-hmm. Because attitude, character, and effort creates results. Mm-hmm. And we didn't talk about what's the outcome. So maybe we'll get him back and talk about some of his special people. But I just thought that guy was top notch.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was interesting. He was telling us over breakfast actually this morning that, you know, he had to let someone go because they only had two of the three characteristics.
Yeah.
They had negative character attitude. And yeah, they had effort, and they could be, and they had the potential to be an amazing salesperson, but they had a negative attitude. And that negative attitude was like a virus on his team.
Yeah, two out of three is not a winning combination.
Right. You have to have all three.
Exactly. So what do you think about it?
I thought it was amazing. You know, he talked about how he crashed and burned and he could have given up, right? He could have said, I'm just not cut out for this, or I can't do this. Someone else take on that role.
Or he could have been all pissed off and angry and slammed doors.
He could have blamed people.
He took the lesson.
Right. And he said, no, I'm going to go back. And next time we do this, I am going to crush it. And he did.
Ever crash and burn?
I did crash and burn, actually.
Ooh.
So.
And ladies and gentlemen, Jen, crashing and burning.
So you spoke about how you have never been nervous for a talk. Mm-hmm. Well, in one of my former companies, I had to give a talk to my peers at the company and mm-hmm. to people who were higher up than I was. And I had to get everyone on board for this major project. And I had 1.5 days to put together a ton of research and an amazing talk, like a 3-hour talk on exactly what the plan was going to be. Well, I had no idea what to do. I had never given a talk in public. I had presented to customers, but I had never given a talk, you know, like where people were in rows, lined up, and I was in the front of the room.
Exactly.
Okay, projector, spotlight on me. And someone told me, oh, it's easy. When you get up there, you have to tell a joke. You have to be funny. So the first thing you do is you have to tell a joke. Okay? Now, I didn't get much guidance from anyone about it, like my boss or anything. And all he said was my entire promotion was sort of hanging on this. So that created extra anxiety.
No pressure there.
Okay? So I get up to the front of the room and I mess up my joke.
There you go. That's a great
start. So now I am just totally red. I am sweating. I mean, you could just see me pouring out sweat. I am incredibly embarrassed. And I had memorized my talk because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to tell a joke and then memorize a talk. For anyone who's listening, horrible advice. Never do this, okay? And so I couldn't remember my first line. But if I couldn't remember my first line, I couldn't go on with the talk because I wouldn't remember anything. So I couldn't get to the next part. So luckily for me, my right-hand person stands up and he goes and he retells the joke for me because I am just like literally blue, like not even just red. I'm blue. And he retells a joke, people actually laugh. And then he says, and Jen, you were gonna talk about this and that. I'm like, oh, right, okay, so let me get into it. And after that, I knew the material really well, so I was mm-hmm. able to flow from there. But I went home and I was distraught. I thought I had embarrassed myself forever in front of people who I really wanted to gain their respect. Mm-hmm. And this was the worst thing on the planet that could have happened, and I allowed it to happen. And so I thought about, well, what can I do so this never happens again? Mm-hmm. Because I never want to be in that situation where I feel where I'm sweating, and it's just a horrible feeling. And I immediately signed up for a presentation course, a 3-day course on presentations, where you actually had to give presentations all 3 days and mm-hmm. get filmed and get feedback. And it was scary for me. I was trembling.
Most people don't want to see themselves.
No, I didn't want to, but it was so amazing and helpful to see myself and to see, okay, don't do that, do more of that, you know, and get coached on it. And eventually, I realized I love giving talks.
Exactly.
And I made it my business to give talks and to get really, really, really great at it because I could never be in that situation again.
I was always confident of my information. And when you're confident of your information and you're prepared to give a talk, you don't get nervous. You might get excited, but you don't get nervous. And the first talk that I gave here in Charlotte was at a Chamber of Commerce in Gastonia, and they offered to film it on VHS, on the camera that had the VHS thing. And I got it. I got the film at the end, and I couldn't wait to get home, pop some popcorn, and sit back and watch the king.
You are a rare breed, but I think that people can be confident in what they're presenting,
mm-hmm.
but knowing how to present is a totally different skill, and that throws some people off.
Well, I agree.
You may be confident in that, but I was not.
However,
originally,
when I watched the video, I actually sucked, and now
the truth comes out.
Right. Well, I'm holding onto my armchair, and I couldn't even move my hand. I was so angry, and I looked at it and I said, "No, I have to watch this again." So I watched basically what was a 3-hour presentation for the second time. Only this time, I took notes about what was I doing wrong and what could I do that would be better so that that wouldn't happen again. And literally, for the first 3 years of my speaking career, I carried it in my pocket and a folded up piece of paper. And before I ever gave another talk, I would take the piece of paper out and look at it. I would actually, in many cases, if there was a table or a lectern, I'd put the piece of paper right there. And it was about my gestures, and it was about smiling, and it was about all the things that I could control. Mm-hmm. I couldn't control my hair. I couldn't, things that you just can't, but I could control looking.
You can
control
your hair.
Yeah, I could, but
maybe not
now. Right. But the challenge for me was, what could I do better and keep getting better at it? So you do it for 3 years, you get better.
You get really good.
So don't think if you give a crappy speech, you're going to die. You're not. You're just going to get better. But you have to film yourself in order to see where you're not that good.
Mm-hmm.
So
at that point, I made it my mission
to get better.
To be an amazing speaker.
Exactly.
Because I didn't like being bad at something.
No.
And then I realized it can be fun.
So the challenge for Pete is he has all the skills. Mm-hmm. And now it's up to him to convey that, to encourage his people to win, to be the champion and cheerleader, because he's the SEAL. He's the guy who passed the test that only 2 out of thousands of people can pass.
Right.
Literally thousands.
Yeah.
And he has to
And
be
even
able
when
to,
thousands of people pass it, they don't stay in the program.
No.
It's hard.
So what else did you take away from Peter?
So there was this interesting, he had a trend in his stories when, mm-hmm. When he was talking about coaching his salespeople. And one of the main themes I noticed was he will go so far to let someone almost lose a sale, not lose it, because he's competitive.
Right.
And he won't lose, but almost lose a sale just to teach them the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most
and he doesn't
sales,
want to coach them in public.
Right.
He'll coach them privately.
In private.
And then tell them to go back in and go do it.
Right. And most sales leaders I know were amazing salespeople and then became leaders.
Mm-hmm.
He has this, and some of them are really great at leading, and some of them
this guy's got leadership
are
qualities,
really great
though.
At selling but not leading.
Yeah.
And they will, if they were in that room when that girl didn't hand the piece of paper,
mm-hmm.
they would have, oh, here you go. Right? But the girl never would have learned the lesson. She never would have gotten better.
This is a great show today. I'm very, very grateful for people who exist like Pete James. I thanked him for his service to the country.
That was phenomenal.
I think that most people don't get the fact that people lay their lives on the line in the military, and I don't think we do enough for them.
I agree.
I really don't.
I agree.
So
if you're out there and you served our country, thank you.
You can board ahead of me in the airplane now.
Rightfully so.
Okay, so my name is Jeffrey Gittimer, and I'm wishing you adieu, and my partner,
Jennifer Gluckow.
Yeah? Are you going to say goodbye or what?
Oh, goodbye.
And I'm
so long.
I'm challenging you to get out there and sell even if your asphalt is off.